Hello, and welcome to episode number 90 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exoacademian. For a long period of modern history, the matter of the so-called UFO phenomenon remained a topic cast to the fringes of discourse. While there has always been a committed community of people dedicated to getting to the bottom of this enduring enigmatic mystery, that group has operated, for the most part, in the margins of polite society. And while the general public has long believed in the likely existence of extraterrestrial life in the cosmos, as have most astrophysicists for that matter, the subject of some of that sophisticated alien life already being in our midst has been a different matter altogether, one for the most part subjected to the conspiracy theory bin amongst the mainstream. That clear distinction between these two statements, that other life exists in the cosmos, and that some of that life is already visiting us, began to dissolve somewhat with the revelations brought forward by David Grush, an insider who has come into contact with clear evidence not just of the presence of these aliens in our midst, but furthermore of contact, communication, and even agreements being made between elements of the U.S. government and its military services and these factions of so-called non-human intelligence. For those subjected to the historic enterprise known as alien abduction, these revelations raise new and troubling questions about just how much human governments have known about this matter and, furthermore, despite public denials, may have been party to them. It is one thing to come to grips with the notion that sophisticated intelligences are able to take you from the comfort of your home with impunity. It is another matter altogether to learn that perhaps your own government has been privy to these activities and that they may have been part of an accord struck between these other intelligences and human governments. And yet this is precisely what is on the table, not just as a result of the allegations brought forward by David Grush, but also because of details that have been provided elsewhere, going into greater detail as to the nature of these accords as they pertain to the matter of abductions. In this week's podcast, we're going to delve into one such account that purports to describe the nature of the cooperative aspect of these events, detailing how a deeply compartmented element of the U.S. Air Force was made aware of abductions via telepathic communication received by personnel who had been genetically altered to enhance their capacity to receive said messages from the faction of non-human intelligence who had made this accord. If true, the implications of this accord are not only consequential, but for many, they are also deeply disquieting. But of course, such topics are not ones we shy away from on this podcast. Just how much have human governments, or segmented aspects of them, actually known about these historic abductions? And how exactly was intel passed from an alien faction to a group of human beings privy to this sweeping enterprise? These are precisely the matters we'll be delving into in this, the 90th episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. As we begin this week's podcast, I'd just like to remind everyone that if you're interested in getting access to all of my content, which includes not just Point of Convergence and Liminal Frames episodes, but also OTC Squared and the feature series I create, then you can do so by becoming a patron on patreon.com/exoacademian or by becoming a subscriber on Spotify. Both of those options also give you access to my community Discord server where we continue this conversation throughout the week. All right, diving into this week's episode. This is going to be a controversial one, but there are reasons why I believe this is important information and credible information. We're going to be discussing the revelations put forward in a book titled Above Black, Project Preserve Destiny, an insider's account of alien contact and government cover-up. This book was written by a man named Dan Sherman. I'm going to dive right into the book in just a moment, but let me just begin by saying, as I hinted at a minute ago, I have reason to believe the revelations put forward in this book are credible. That is to say, people in the know, so to speak, have suggested this book to me and to others, indicating that it contains intelligence which is accurate. In other words, these events are, for the most part, described accurately and do depict actual historical events. Now, like David Grush and Lou Elizondo and others like them, Dan Sherman considers himself a patriot. He does not write this book with the intention of damaging national security, and he addresses that in this opening section. Quote, "As far as I'm concerned, the information I know relating to Project Preserve Destiny, PPD for short, specifically, has absolutely no impact on national security. Perhaps if they had been more forthcoming with the truth and made me aware of a greater goal that did impact national security, I wouldn't be coming forward today. But they didn't, so here we are. The story I've documented in this book is an authentic first-level account of the existence of aliens. It is a story of my personal experiences as an intuitive communicator with the United States Air Force while working for the National Security Agency. My going public with this story will hopefully be considered by historians of the future as the catalyst that opened the gate to the flow of relevant and concrete information regarding the government's role in the cover-up of alien-related information." Unquote. By the way, I should clarify here that this book was written quite a long time ago. In the late 20th century, 1998, I think, was when it was originally published. So this is not brand new groundbreaking information. It's been out there in the public domain, so to speak. But again, as is often the case, these aspects of truth have been out there. These elements of the actual historical enterprise have been in the public domain, as David Grush suggested. Again, detractors of Grush's revelations claim that he had just put together a hodgepodge of all of the historical ufological lore rather than accessing real information. But of course, the irony here is that the lore does contain real information. That's the point. David Grush's revelations make clear that much of what has leaked out is true. The biggest offense the DOD and the secret keepers have had is that this information is just such a mind stretcher that most people don't take it seriously. And that was indeed the case with this book as well. Like I said, it's been out for over two decades. Most people don't take it seriously, but I've been told that we should. Now, continuing with the clarification that Sherman offers in the beginning of the book here, quote, "So while preparing this book for release, I had to take certain precautions regarding legitimately classified information. My regular Air Force job was as an electronic intelligence specialist. The Air Force describes this career field as analyzing electromagnetic energy for intelligence value. In more simple terms, I would analyze the internal characteristics of energy emanating from a piece of equipment, such as a radar, to see what kind of transmission it emitted and determine exactly how the actual signal would operate so we could identify the radar's function. People in this career field are called ELINT specialists or ELINTers. Some of what I did as an ELINTer isn't any more classified than the secret level or below. However, some of the things I worked on would be considered in the above top secret realm. It is this realm that I would start treading on thin ice." Unquote. Now again, just to make this clear, he's saying that some of his information detailing his actual known job, his known position, would contain some classified information, and there he has to tread lightly. But the way that he goes into describing how this worked is very interesting. Basically, he said that whenever he had these secret activities to do with Greys, with aliens, and accords that had been made with elements of U.S. military personnel, he would have a cover story of another operation he was working on, which was detailed, which is part of the historical record. So if there ever was any kind of uncovering here, it would look like he was doing known things, part of operations that had been already declared as part of the overarching, for instance, supervision from Congress and things like that. But while he had these known, declared operations he was working on, there was a second operation that he was working on to do with this super secret alien accord enterprise. And that was never on the books, so to speak. So there would be no historical record to find if someone went looking for it. So this is very key. Not only was it not included in the historical record, but secondly, and more importantly, he was always covered by other operations he was working on during that same time. He goes into the book that sometimes he would work during the day under one position and then in the evening work on this other position. Or sometimes later on, it would just be part of his day. But again, if someone were to look at the historical record, they would see that he was an ELINT specialist and nothing else. Again, that's how this was covered up so well. So we really have to rely on his description of what was actually going on rather than what we can find in the historical record. I'm now going to jump into a book where he describes this process specifically. Quote, "When someone is assigned to an alien project, they are also assigned to the collateral black mission or cover mission. One of the reasons for this is if someone were to reveal any alien information, by extension, they would most likely reveal something about the cover project, and it would be on this basis that someone would be prosecuted for divulging classified information. By setting it up this way, the government is able to effectively silence and discredit someone without ever having to acknowledge the existence of the alien project. Hopefully, I will avoid this scenario by methodically unfolding my story. So while preparing this book for release, I had to take certain precautions regarding legitimately classified information." Unquote. And again, that's where he gets into his ELINT specialty. And if he were to reveal information from there, he could actually violate his NDA. So this is where he has to tread lightly, and he does focus on that throughout the book. All right, with that preamble aside, let's jump into the next part of the book. And this is where things get very, very interesting. While he is in the Air Force, he is greeted by this one particular supervisor and then told something quite shocking about his history. Let's jump into it. Quote, "To put it bluntly, Sergeant Sherman, in the summer of 1960, your mother was visited by what the world commonly refers to as aliens. Sir? Was the only thing I could manage to say." He continues, "Random tests were being conducted on the general populace at the time to determine compatibility. I was in a state of utter disbelief when I asked in a weak, crackling voice, 'Compatibility?' His superior continued, quote, 'Yes, actually it's a long story. I'll try to explain as much as I can, but there's much that I don't even know. In a nutshell, you've been given an interesting ability through what we call genetic management,' unquote." And he goes on to say, "My mother, genetic management, compatibility, long story. My mind was reeling with all this new information. I came in here expecting to find out about a deployment for an exercise, or perhaps that I had incorrectly filled out my travel voucher, but not this." As though the captain could sense how much shock I was experiencing, he said, quote, "I know all of this is going to be hard to swallow, but I can assure you it's true. All at once, I became overwrought with a sense of amazement and curiosity. Captain White sat in front of me, calm and relaxed, telling me that aliens existed, as if he were merely sharing with me the topic of an obscure news item he read in yesterday's paper. If this was true, then all of those years of boyhood wondering had just been validated in one fell swoop. There was life elsewhere, and we were not alone in this vast universe. Was I dreaming? Could this really be happening? I had heard rumors through the classified grapevine of alien craft experiments in Nevada and the testing of new weapons based on alien technology. But this was no longer a rumor. This was reality, my reality. All these things were going through my mind as the captain continued with his remarkable revelations." The captain continues, quote, "I mentioned you have a unique ability. We call it intuitive communications. It's an ability to communicate through the intuitive manipulation of your mind. There have been a handful of people since this ability was perfected that have utilized this skill within the military establishment. There are many others throughout the general world populace that currently have this ability, but until it is brought out by the proper exercise methods, it lays dormant." Unquote. Now again, some people are going to be shocked by this. Some people are going to find this hard to believe. Again, for those people, I would point them to something like the SRI initiative to establish the remote viewing protocols, which of course was funded by the CIA. So we have history where different military groups have pursued these PSY components. And in this case, we have the United States Air Force, after genetic manipulation of a human being, by the way, using PSY to actually communicate and to run these accords with various alien groups. And Sherman is finding out about this right here and finding out that he is one of these people that's been genetically manipulated in such a way as to increase this capacity in him. But importantly, the point is also made here that many people in the human population also have this gift, this skill, this innate ability, but they cannot access it. They cannot use it effectively unless they go through certain training protocols. Again, we think about the training with remote viewing at SRI. So that's indeed what Sergeant Sherman ends up going through. And then he finds he does indeed have some remarkable capabilities. And we'll get there. First, let's continue with Captain White's briefing of Sergeant Sherman. Quote, Captain White spoke slowly at first, as if to gently nudge the unbelievable truth in my direction. He said, quote, in 1947, the U.S. government made contact with an alien species. Today, we commonly refer to them as Greys. Because of this contact, we have learned many things. Some of the things we have learned were good, and some not so good. And it's one of those not so good things that has ultimately brought you here, Sergeant Sherman. He says then, my mind was still swimming as I asked, so what am I doing here, sir? The captain continued with his story as if he hadn't heard me. In 1960, an experiment was given a great deal of attention within level one circles. Excuse me, sir, I interrupted. What is level one? I was just getting there. Level one is a classification category that allows us to compartmentalize any and all gray information. You'll hear more about this at your security indoctrination later. I see, the captain went on. The experiment that I'm referring to was, and still is, named Project Preserve Destiny. It started in 1960 and was fully operational by 1963. It was a genetic management project with the sole purpose of cultivating human offspring so that they would have the ability to communicate with the Greys. Your mother was initially abducted in 1960 for tests, then again in 1963 for the actual genetic procedure while you were in the womb. Each moment in Captain White's office was more shocking than the last. In the seconds after each new revelation, my mind went through utter disbelief, followed by skepticism, then outright curiosity. How could this be happening to me? Aliens were the made-up fantasies of Hollywood filmmakers and science fiction book writers. They had no place within the concrete, tangible realm of the U.S. military. Yet here I sat in front of a U.S. Air Force captain with two connected silver bars on each shoulder, listening to what most people would recognize as a great little alien story. At some point in our conversation, I can't remember exactly when, I became a believer. First out of my own desire to believe, then ultimately in my inability to avoid the information being presented to me. And then the captain continues, quote, your abilities are a product of Project Preserve Destiny, Sergeant Sherman. I was about to ask a question when the captain directed my attention back to the screen as if to say, not yet, there's more. I was expecting pictures of aliens and other science fiction types of stuff. Instead, I was treated to a healthy dose of facts and bullet statements. In January of 1963, the first successfully managed embryo was produced under PPD supervision. There were only a certain number of INTCOM-capable personnel required. Hence, the genetic management phase of PPD was terminated in March of 1968. I accurately surmised that INTCOM was a shortened name for Intuitive Communications. I later learned that I would be referred to as an IC. And then Captain White continued, quote, because INTCOM abilities really cannot be fully utilized biologically until the subject is approximately 25 years old or older, we have just recently begun the recruiting and training phase of PPD. Because the selection process in 1960 was based on carefully calculated statistical demographics, they were able to accurately predict that a certain percentage of those offspring would choose the military as a career, unquote. And by the way, later on we find out that there is some heavy-handed influencing that perhaps leads Sherman to go into the military, and specifically the Air Force, obviously with the aim of them protecting their investment, and we will touch on that more later. Now, according to Sherman, what he then finds out is about the onion-like layering of classification, and he learns that anything to do with communication, contact, and accords with the Greys was at a level of classification above everything else, hence the title of the book, Above Black. That's just how secret it was. And again, as we discussed earlier, there was also always a cover mission which could be pointed to if someone tried to look into his career. So again, this looks largely invisible according to the historical documents, but yet it was going on simultaneously. These gray projects were happening as well. The captain also goes on to say, when asked by Sherman why this was kept secret from the public, that the reasoning was largely that their psychological / sociological assessment of the general populace was such that they didn't think people could handle it. It would be too destabilizing to society, hence why they chose to keep it secret. And again, not surprisingly, in exchange for letting these abductions take place of citizens while looking the other way, the U.S. military would have access to technological secrets that would give them geopolitical dominance for decades to come. Now I'm going to jump into a section where the captain is describing the final layer of the onion, using that analogy again. Quote, "Last but not least, on the trip through the onion, we come to the alien missions or level one, referred to as gray matter, or slant missions. The center of the onion always contains the alien project. Not even the commander of a site is normally aware of the alien project residing beneath his nose." The captain then is quoted as saying, "Anyone who is or has been part of an alien project is considered to be first level or level one personnel. Personnel who serve in a support function to the first level are considered second level and are unaware of the link between their jobs and the alien project they are covering for. They work with the cover or black missions. In addition, the existence of the entire level system is only known by first level people." Then the captain is quoted as saying, "It gets even more complicated. Within level one, there are separate and distinct categories called steps, which directly correspond with your need to know." And then Sherman says, "As he was explaining this onion effect, I remember being fascinated by the ingenuity of the system. It was obviously very effective in preventing information from being revealed." Unquote. Now again, as I already mentioned, he always had a cover story, a cover mission that he was working on while he was also working on his PPD activities. And he mentions that when it gets to the point where his first E-Link classes begin. Quote, "My E-Link classes began without a hitch. The E-Link school was held at one of the NSA's office complexes just north of Fort Meade called the FANX, pronounced Fanix. It was a challenge to go to my day classes and be expected to attend my night classes for PPD. By the end of the first month, I was exhausted. The exhaustion I felt wasn't so much a physical exhaustion as it was mental. Both classes were mentally challenging, but the PPD classes were challenging on a different level, a level I wasn't even aware existed prior to PPD school." Unquote. Okay, so let me set the stage here. Basically, during the daytime, he would go to his E-Link classes because he was going to become an E-Link specialist. That was always his cover mission, what you would see if you actually looked into his history. Now, in the evenings, he was taken by van to another location, an undisclosed location. He never knew where it was. They made him wear a blindfold while he went there, and there was no visible signs of buildings and stuff around once he got there, which led him to believe that he was underground, perhaps, in some facility. He was led out of the van and then taken into a different building where he was eventually taken to a room, sat down in front of a computer where his training classes would begin. Let's pick up right there. Quote, "My first lesson that first day in PPD class consisted of listening to one tone and watching a box on my screen that had a perfect sine wave running through it. A perfect 360-degree sine wave is a line that forms a perfect arc and then repeats itself as a negative arc. There were 10 boxes like this one. I was told to listen to the tone and try to repeat it by mentally humming it, not verbally, only mentally. At the same time, I was to watch my first box to look for movement of the sine wave. The goal was to see the sine wave flatten completely. This was obviously exotic technology I was working with, because how else could I affect a change on a sine wave without being hooked to it somehow? Other than the headphones, which were only used to listen to my instructor, I had no connection to the computer on which I was working. I had a hard time believing I was going to be able to manipulate the sine wave with only my mind. Nevertheless, I listened to my instructor and did what I was told. The process was slow, arduous, and extremely boring. That first day was defeating. I started wondering if I was going to be a disappointment because I couldn't flatten my line. As I practiced mentally humming this note, I was told to watch the sine wave for any movement. I was told that I would see the sine wave bend towards the center line, essentially making the sine wave flat. It was around this time that I started to wonder how this skill would be applied to communicating with aliens. It was a frustrating time, not only because my progress was excruciatingly slow, but I was questioning the validity of the ability in the first place. It wasn't until my third day that I saw progress. Imagine mentally humming a note for 3 to 4 hours straight for 3 days. It was borderline torture. I was beginning to think my abilities were defective in some way. During this whole time, my instructor was of no help. He didn't speak to me much during my first 3 days because he couldn't do anything with me until I began to flatten my line. When I finally saw progress, I nearly shot out of my seat and danced around the room. I was sitting there looking at my screen as usual, feeling defeat as I had been for the past 2 days, when something clicked in my mind. It's very difficult to explain, but I felt what seemed to be an audible click in my mind. Just at that moment, my sine wave flickered. Up until this point, that sine wave had been as solid as a rock, with absolutely no movement. So when it finally did move, it startled me. I wasn't anticipating what had just happened. When the click happened, a straight line appeared on the screen that marked the top of the positive sine wave, the part of the sine wave above the straight line, and it stretched all the way to the hash mark to the left of the screen. It gave you the ability to gauge exactly how flat the line was becoming. Each hash mark represented 30 degrees of flattening. There was a readout at the top right-hand corner of each sine wave box that would keep a constant record of the flattest your line in that particular box had ever become, as well as the most recent measurement. Unquote. Again, very interesting. Thinking again about remote viewing protocols and how those kinds of things were conducted. When I myself have attempted remote viewing, what I found very interesting that shows a parallel with what he experienced here is when you finally do realize you've come across information that is accessing something beyond your imagination or memory. In other words, you really are receiving intelligence, information that is not through one of your usual senses. You do have the sense of something clicking. You have the sense that it's right, even though you don't know why it's right. And again, that came to my mind when I read this particular account from Sherman. Perhaps not surprisingly, once he had accomplished that first flattening of the sine wave, it became more natural because he had established a kind of firing and wiring of his neuronal network, and he could begin to repeat this. But of course, this was just the beginning. He is then given much more complicated tasks, but again, his capacities at this point are increasing and doing so quickly. He continues, quote, "The next day of PPD classes, after successfully flattening all my lines, was by far the most challenging. One of the exciting parts about PPD school was that I never knew from one day to the next what to expect. Each day was a mystery. This day brought the next big challenge, flattening 2 lines at one time. My instructor told me to mentally visualize 2 points in space, each representing separate tones that would be alternately played in the headphones. As I did this, I was to force the 2 points together, creating 1 point in space. He said that they would resist one another like opposite poles of a magnet, but that I had to visualize myself sapping the energy from each of them, bringing that energy towards myself so that they would no longer be able to force themselves apart. This exercise proved extremely difficult. My mind felt like it was weightlifting the whole time. I thought the hard part of the school had ended, but it had only begun. It took me a full week to realize my goal of bringing these first 2 points in space together. By the time I was able to do this, my will to continue with PPD school had almost been broken once again. I think that if I had been given a choice, I would have ended my PPD schooling midway through that crucial week." Unquote. Of course, he was not given that option of quitting, and later on we find out indeed that quitting altogether, leaving the Air Force altogether, was not something easily done. Again, not surprisingly, because the Air Force had already committed a lot of resources, time, energy, and funding for his training, going all the way back to efforts that were made with his mother when she was pregnant with him. Continuing on with the book, quote, "The goal during my 4th week was to practice and master flattening lines in different combinations at once. By this time, I could feel movement in the boxes. Only later did I realize that it was quite similar to communicating with my alien contacts. The windows not only were responding to my input, I could sense their output as well. This helped me in subsequent lessons. It would be vital in learning to assign relative meaning to the intuition. The audio tones, so crucial in the early stages of my development, had ceased. The tones were only used so that my human mind could relate to something tangible to lead me to uncover what my mind could naturally do once I had discovered and practiced it. The tones could be described as the bridge. I had reached my destination. Now I had only to learn to navigate in this new world. In order to practice flattening separate combinations of lines at once, I would watch my screen and see when different sine wave boxes would light up. They would light up in different sequences, first one at a time. Then it progressed to two at once, then three, four, five, etc. All 10 would then light up at once, and I would have to flatten all the lines at one time. My lessons were becoming much easier in comparison to my lessons earlier in the learning process. I could feel my skills becoming much stronger. I began to enjoy the school more because it wasn't so much of a threat to my ego anymore. It was as if I had only taken off the training wheels and was riding just fine on my own. Only now I was getting to ride progressively bigger bikes, which was very exhilarating. At this point, though, I still couldn't quite make the connection between what I was learning and how it would be applied to actual communication. Unquote. Again, that's a very interesting section because he talks about this bridging that happens, that at first the sounds are used just to connect two aspects of his mind because it is unfamiliar to him. But once that's done, he doesn't need any kind of prompt through his usual senses for this to take place. And that's exactly what happens later on when he actually does have his first contact with the Greys. And again, we'll get there. But before we move into the part of the book where he's in the field and actually does have these telepathic communications, he first has to go through one major additional component in his training. And he details that in this next section. Quote, "On the first day of concepts, I was shown some pictures and sine wave boxes would simply begin lighting up in quick sequences with each at a different degree of flattening. I would automatically remember and understand that the flattening sequence represented the pictures shown at the time. In one day, we went from still pictures to video, with my mind grasping the line flattening combinations as quickly as they came. It was much like a large-scale memorization process. Sometimes I found myself in awe of what was happening." And then he goes on to say, "The last thing I learned was how to open a window to document the results of my future communications, referred to as comms. In order to document the comm I would be receiving from my alien contact, I had to open an interface window in the background of my computer screen. The day I was to learn this, I came to school to find a mouse set up near my computer terminal. In order to open the window, I had to click the far right button of my mouse and press the F10 key while the arrow was resting on the background screen of the computer. A dialog box would appear with several choices. During this reporting part of my lesson, my instructor became very vocal. All the teaching regarding the reporting procedures was done entirely via the headphones, with my instructor speaking the whole time. My instructor went on to say that at each place I would be stationed, I would have the same PPD code name designated in the computer system. My code name would be Staunch 118. After bringing up the dialog box, I could highlight Staunch 118 in the menu and type in my password. My password would be given to me at each base I reported to separately. So I typed in the test password he gave me after choosing Staunch 118 in the background screen of my computer. A separate window appeared with a blank screen. I was told that I would never see anything contained within the screen, not even what I was typing. This was for security purposes, in case someone were to see what I was typing by accident. It was at this time I was taught how the comms were to be reported. There were no hard and fast rules for reporting comms. I was to separate each part of the comm by a forward slash symbol and was to place three of those at the very end of my report. That was it. Simple and to the point. There were many questions I had, but by this time I knew enough to not ask my instructor because he wasn't exactly forthcoming with any information. He stuck to my lesson and that was it. No more, no less. My official lessons were over after the reporting class. I can't remember for how much longer I was in Maryland, but however long it was, I continued to come to the PPD school to practice my skills. I would come to watch videos and watch my sine wave boxes light up in response to my repeating back intuitively what I was seeing in the videos. By this time, I could no longer correlate what the boxes were doing, but it sure looked impressive seeing the boxes light up. My instructor would sometimes ask me to repeat certain video scenes again, so it appeared that they were able to monitor my results for accuracy. I'm not exactly sure how. The videos I was watching had no audio. They were random recordings of people walking down the street, nature, people working, military aircraft flying. There was an overwhelming amount of military images, which I took as a sign I would be reporting primarily military-oriented comms. There must have been 24 hours of video. As far as accuracy, my instructor only had me repeat a few things. In essence, I assumed by now that I had mastered my abilities. Unquote. Now, as the book continues, we find Sherman actually being assigned to a base. He doesn't identify the bases, by the way, for reasons of national security, but he does mention going to several bases where he had, again, gray-related activities as well as traditional activities, the cover job, so to speak. Importantly, there was never any real paper trail or even an email trail, an electronic trail, because he was always passed off from one person to another. And again, a strict need to know was enforced. So one captain would introduce him to another one who is going to be his supervisor, or at least be responsible for giving him additional information. Again, sometimes Sherman concluded that he actually knew more than the person that was briefing him. Again, strict need to knows and limited information was the norm. This is how the secrecy was kept. I'm now going to a section of the book where he talks about his first stationing. Quote, Don and Sergeant Larson left the conference room. The captain motioned for me to close the door. This is it, I said to myself. D-Day has arrived. I had waited for over 7 months from the time I left school to now, and now the time was finally here. As you probably know by now, Sergeant Sherman, the captain began, you are here to do more than the one job. Yes, sir, I replied. I was so glad to find out more about the actual duties. I was hanging on his every word. He continued, quote, in a moment, we'll be going over to your new work center. I want to familiarize you with the computer terminal you'll be working from. It's the same terminal you will be documenting your IC comms on. Before we do that, though, I'd like to mention a few words on security. You do realize you're not to speak of this project to anyone at any time besides me, right? Yes, sir, I replied again. I knew that from what Captain White had said, I was not to speak to anyone unless I had a third-party introduction. Captain White had told me to speak to Captain Stanley, and I presumed the next person I spoke to about PPD would be introduced to me by one of them, and so on. Great, the captain went on. Due to the nature of your regular job here, you will not be able to access the van you'll be working in without being accompanied by another cleared person. This presents a problem when you are documenting your comms, as you will soon see. The van you and the partner will be working in is extremely cramped. Therefore, any documentation of comms you take down will be susceptible to being seen by your partner. Because of that, we have taken the necessary steps to make sure that does not happen. You'll see what I mean when we tour the van. Do you have any questions before we do that? I knew exactly what he meant, but evidently he didn't know that I knew. He was most likely talking about the blank reporting screen. He was probably unaware that I was taught this in school, but I did have a question. How am I to know when to start communications with my alien contact? I asked. Just for the record, Sergeant Sherman, never use that word. It's referred to as gray. Please get used to not referring to it at all. But if it is unavoidable, the word is gray. In answer to your question, though, I have no idea. You're the expert in that area, not me. You are the first IC that I have ever worked with. This revelation was a bit shocking. How long have you been in the program, sir? I asked, hoping I didn't sound too presumptuous or naive. That is unimportant, he said. But suffice to say that not many people have worked with actual IC personnel. I don't know if you know this, but you and the other IC-capable personnel represent the culmination of 30-some years of wait and see. It's been a long time coming and is very exciting to the people involved. You are part of the first wave of what will be a small but steady stream of IC-capable and trained personnel. For most of us, this is all new territory we're charting, so if it seems like something isn't as organized as you would expect, it's because we're flying blind sometimes. Let's make our way to the van and I'll show you your new computer terminal, unquote. So just to clarify again, here we see in plain sight the need to know, the compartmentalization. Again, some of the people that are his superiors know less than he does and certainly don't know the details of his training. Now you heard mention of a van. That's basically where these comms are recorded, is within a cramped van with computer terminals and such. And then remember again, this is quite a while ago, decades ago, in fact. So these are rather rudimentary computers. and yet this remarkable kind of communication was happening. All right, now with all of this training behind him, we get to the part of the book where he actually details communication that happened between him and a particular gray, and to pass on a specific kind of information. Let's jump to that section now. Quote, "I got to the site a bit early since this was my first night without someone supervising me. I wanted to make sure I did everything correctly. My crew partner showed up and we were authenticated properly with security personnel in order to open the C-van for the 12-hour shift ahead of us. As we made our way into the C-van, I had just silenced the alarm box and started to power up my equipment when I intuitively received a message. Quote, prepare for information string, unquote. I was so startled I uttered some unintelligible noise, then followed that with an audible, wait. My crew partner asked me what he was to wait for. Oh, sorry, just talking to myself, I said automatically, not wanting him to think I was crazy. I wasn't quite sure what to do about the impending calm since my computer was not up and running yet. It took a certain amount of time for the computer to boot and I had at least 2 to 3 minutes to wait still. At the same time I had audibly said wait, I had also sent back a comm saying wait. I realized this only after I had mentally replayed the situation later. I had never vocalized any comm before. I never did it again either, but the comm took me by such surprise that my auditory faculties were affected along with my intuitive abilities." Unquote. And now he describes how the actual communication worked. Remembering again that 118 was his code number, this is the way it worked. Quote, "A sample comm at this point would have looked similar to this. 118/67555/9955004/0004-0004-3/47477899054/9400/... The comms would simply be a series of numbers separated by a forward slash character. This was the way I was taught to separate comm sections while in school. Anytime there was a pause, I would place the forward slash character in between phrases. Sometimes I could pick out obvious things like latitude and longitude. When I first noticed lat longs being communicated, I wanted to look them up on a map, but we didn't have any detailed maps in our C-van, and I was terrified of writing anything down and taking it with me. I soon lost motivation to look up the locations. I got the point finally of taking most things for granted. It became a very boring task to receive these comms and type them into this blank window. It certainly wasn't very challenging, and I lost all interest in it simply because it was only a one-way communication for all intents and purposes. Once in a while, I would send back a comm saying, repeat last phrase, or something like that. But most of the time, it was a one-way street and not an exciting job. After some time had passed since that first comm, I took the liberty of naming the gray contact I had communicated with Spock. My best friend had always been a big Star Trek fan and it seemed a befitting name." Unquote. Now, while Sherman describes here what had become a rather routine, even boring kind of procedure, a one-way street as he said, eventually he stumbled across a new kind of protocol. Again, it was completely by accident. At one point, he basically just reached a new level of frequency and his gray contact seemed to recognize it. And they actually began to have a conversation back and forth. It was no longer just a one-way street. And Sherman even goes on to ask questions about grays and their culture, their history, that kind of thing. And he is given information in return. Then just when he's getting to know Spock well, he finds out he is transferred to another base, so a second base. And again, there's a relatively long waiting period before he finally is introduced to a new contact in addition to his cover story again, his cover job. And eventually, he's sat down at a new station and a new kind of communication is established. This time it's with another gray who he calls Bones. Again, of course, calling on the Star Trek history there. Now, Bones, again, in addition to passing on information, he's also able to raise the level, raise the frequency, and Bones recognizes this and they begin to have a conversation. And Sherman finds out that, of course, other people on the base, including his supervisors, have no way of knowing this is happening because they don't have the intuitive capacities he has, these telepathic capacities he has to be able to communicate with the gray back and forth. So the only other being alive that knows this is happening is the gray he's speaking to. And the gray says it is not against protocol for him to ask these questions. So he does carry on asking various questions about the Greys and their history. However, as time goes on, while that was encouraging and enjoyable to him, he begins to become uncomfortable with what is actually going on, and specifically in terms of what kinds of intelligence are being passed through him and then passed on to some super elite rogue element of the Air Force that is receiving these comms he's entering invisibly into the screen as a result of these telepathic downloads he gets from the Grey. Specifically, Sherman is eventually able to put two and two together and recognize that what is being passed on, he believes, is information pertaining to abductions. Again, we've already discussed how the notion here is that a faction of these Greys had made an accord with the military, and part of that accord involved these Greys passing on information after the fact, usually within a few days, of when and where abductions had taken place. So that was primarily what was involved in the communication between these forward slashes. It would be coordinates and numbers referring to dates, times, lat and long, that kind of thing. And it was pertaining, Sherman believes, to abductions that were taking place. And eventually this becomes too much for him to bear. He does not want to be part of this. He's never explained why this is necessary or why it's in the interest of the United States or its citizens. And eventually that leads him to wanting to get out of the military. But then, as I referred to earlier, that becomes a particularly difficult task. In fact, when he inquires with his superiors about either being transferred or leaving the military altogether, he is told in very clear terms that this would simply not be allowed. He would never be able to leave because there had been too much of an investment made and there were too few personnel of his kind of ability. So they would not let him leave. He would be asked to stay on, really given no other opportunity but to stay on. Now, what's interesting is eventually he comes up with a different plan to be discharged from the military. He doesn't exactly mention what this plan is. He says it is a known thing that is often not talked about, but secretly different military personnel know about this procedure you can use, this process that will end up getting you discharged. So when he's not given a normal, legitimate way to leave the military, even at the end of his particular enlistment, he uses this sort of fail-safe to be discharged. And that is indeed what happens. And as he says, he never hears from them after that. No doubt they were not happy about this, but they recognized there really was not much they could do because he had resorted to this poison pill, if you will. And thus goes the tale about this person who had been enlisted in the Air Force and then trained in the super secret program pertaining to gray matters, a gray project, and then actually uses his capacities that were enhanced, augmented while he was in the womb of his mother to be able to receive telepathic downloads from gray contacts pertaining to abductions of U.S. citizens. And again, only U.S. citizens. He makes that point. When he checked the Latin longs that were part of these messages, they always reference U.S. locations. So this really was a branch of the U.S. military in cooperation with gray aliens, or if you want to call them future humans. Again, we'll leave that open right now. But this accord happened and it involved the exchange of technology for the looking the other way while abductions took place. But the accord included, shockingly to many, I would believe, actual details about where and when these abductions were taking place. These are the shocking revelations revealed in this book, Above Black, by Dan Sherman. And on that note, we've come to the close of another edition of the Point of Convergence podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian. But until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exoacademian, signing out.